coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver.
Our people are suffering because of the Zionist blockade under the watchful eye of the international community. The situation has only gotten worse amid the coronavirus pandemic.
As infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is catastrophic and is getting worse by the day. The health sector is unable to provide proper medical care to coronavirus patients and even struggles to provide tests for the deadly virus. Gaza has a population of over 2 million and hospitals don't have enough beds for the patients.
The COVID-19 pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system.
Hospitals in the tiny enclave lack medical facilities and medicines to tackle the deadly virus due to years of Israeli blockade. Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health sector since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
More and more Yemeni civilians die in Yemen on a daily basis amid the continuation of the Saudi siege on the Arab country. Here in the Pediatric Leukemia Treatment Center, 50% of patients, namely children, die due to the lack of medicine and medical care they need to survive.
We've suffered a lot to establish this center so that children could have a chance to survive, especially due to the difficulties of traveling abroad. During the past 6 years, we received hundreds of cases, but the death rate is still high. And we hope that the concerned international organizations will do their role so the children could have a normal recovery.
Hundreds of children come to the center from all across Yemen, as it is the only medical center for such patients, hoping that they will receive the required treatment. However, the ongoing war and the crippling blockade have made the center suffer from a permanent shortage of medicines, medical supplies, and radiation devices.
The families of patients come from remote areas. They also face lack of medical supplies. Also, the treatment for leukemia is marrow transplantation, which is very expensive and is carried out outside the country, which is not possible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a's airport.
I come from Al-Mahwit Governorate, which is very far away, and we face a lot of trouble traveling to reach this center, which suffers from a constant shortage of medicines and overcrowding of patients, as it is the only center in Yemen.
The health sector in Yemen is in a dire need of necessary support from international and relief organizations, which have not played their role in alleviating the suffering of the Yemeni people that began in March 2015 due to the Saudi war on Yemen. Hundreds of children lose their lives at the gates of the center due to the lack of medicines and other medical supplies, as well as their inability to travel for treatment due to its high cost and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It's been almost 1 year since the U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the assassination of head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The martyrdom of Haj Qasem, along with head of the Iraqi Popular Forces Haj Abu Mahdi Muhandis, has had a major impact on the region, and specifically Lebanon. The images on the streets of Beirut reflect the news which became general knowledge after his assassination. His role as a representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran in assisting the resistance was instrumental.
Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said this, that he was one of the fathers, the main fathers of the victory of the year 2006. And also what followed after that was the training and the equipment that the Islamic resistance got, that the Israelis are now quite fearsome of.
Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in several speeches that the U.S. crime will not go without punishment, stressing that the martyrdom of Haj Qasem will only strengthen the resistance alliance.
We admit that it was a heavy blow to our resistance alliance. In this life, it was a loss for us, but God Almighty has kept the family and friends and beloved people of Haj Qasem Soleimani for us. Also, the blood of Haj Qasem Soleimani will strengthen and reinforce the path of resistance.
The leader of Al-Quds forces was seen as someone who united many fronts in the region against aggression.
Things are quite interrelated here in the region. You know, whatever happens in what country reflects on the other countries. So his role was quite major, and the act of the assassination that the Americans did was a sort of not only revenge but of a certain defeat, but also a revenge against the defeat of their brains by the brains of Martyr Soleimani.
In a gesture of gratitude, one of the municipalities in southern Beirut named one of the streets after Martyr General Qasem Soleimani, whose name has become immortalized, but what many see here as the spirit of martyrdom.
The important thing that we need to focus on from these examples, from the martyrs that are sacrificing themselves, that our ummah, our nation, is always capable of producing more, and people who have the same spirits, Martyr Suleiman's legacy was quite huge, especially with the issue of the spirit of the martyr.
General Qasem Soleimani was not only seen as a friend of Lebanon and the Lebanese resistance, he was considered by Hezbollah's commanders and leaders as a partner of the resistance who played a key role in achieving liberation for Lebanon in the year 2000 and securing victory for Lebanon in the 2006 war. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and two civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. But we will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resisting groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The airstrikes violate all international laws because Israeli army targets hospitals and residential areas. We hold the Israeli occupation responsible for all the consequences of this aggression.
The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave. Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Resistance figures from Palestine, Syria, and Iraq have marked the first martyrdom anniversary of commander of Iran's Al-Quds force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Damascus, recalling his role in restoring stability to Syria. In a gathering, resistance delegates underlined the importance of his efforts in leading resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine.
General Soleimani exerted huge efforts to support Palestinians in Gaza and occupied territories. He had a great role in raising the morale of Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli aggression. He never interfered in the internal affairs of the Palestinians.
We have gathered here to pay tribute to two great leaders of resistance who lost their lives in fight against enemies of our causes. We tell those who want to create divisions among us that we will remain united and strong and will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani.
On the 3rd of January 2020, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered strikes that killed General Soleimani and his companions near Baghdad International Airport.
Martyr Soleimani led battles in Aleppo and eastern Syria as well as around Damascus. His presence had always boosted the morale of fighters. His presence scared the enemy on the battlefield and at the same time gave power to resistance fighters.
The role of Martyr Soleimani and the alliance of Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian resistance gave a lesson to the U.S. and its allies that they can't defeat our resistance, especially in Syria and Iraq.
Throughout the war on Syria, the general was a top strategist and military commander, leading Iranian military advisors who helped Syria at its government's request in the fight against terrorists. He frequently visited the front lines in Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and joined resistance fighters for advisement, despite knowing he was a target for the U.S. and its allies. The general also took personal command of the battle against Daesh terrorists in the city of Bukamal in Deir ez-Zor countryside in November 2017. For resistance fighters, he was a commander and a father. For Syrians, he was a true friend and a hero. For the Syrian army, he was a brother and an ally who was there whenever needed. And this is how Martyr Qasem Soleimani will be remembered in Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Great hero, General of Hearts. The former top commander of the IRGC Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Organization, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes, and their eight companions attained martyrdom on 3rd of January 2020 in a terrorist attack near Baghdad Airport under direct orders of the outgoing criminal U.S. President Donald Trump. The despicable move occurred whilst Lieutenant General Soleimani had been invited by the Iraqi government and was in Iraq as a guest of the Iraqi government. Donald Trump resorted to his usual excuses to justify his criminal act, trying to say that the act of terrorism was a preemptive move to prevent war in the region. This came whilst U.S. officials themselves had admitted that martyred General Qasem Soleimani played an unmatched role in weeding out terrorism in the region and even prevented the influx of terrorists into Europe and beyond. CNN's website wrote just 2 days after the martyrdom of General Soleimani that senior security officials in the United States were seriously trying to defend the White House's claim that General Soleimani's assassination had been carried out in reaction to the immediate threats of this general to American interests. Abbott added, lack of evidence had cast doubt in Congress and public opinion on whether Donald Trump had done the right move. The assassination of a top Iranian general, a public hero fighting against terrorism, clearly proved that the United States is not fighting terrorism, but it is in fact the partner in crime of terrorists, and indeed the United States is the main supporter of terrorism, a rogue element in the region. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, as a top military strategist, unmasked the mendacity of the U.S. claims of combating terrorism. The United States has been propagating for two decades that it is seeking to bring security and stability to West Asia, whereas the terrorist American army has directly or indirectly committed the most heinous crimes in a number of regional countries, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and other places. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the United States does not want to destroy Daesh terrorists, but it wants to administer and control Daesh in a way to use it as an instrument for advancing its own nefarious goals in the region. But the great martyr of the Islamic resistance, General Qasem Soleimani and his companions, thwarted this U.S. plot. Iran's advisory role in Syria and Iraq paved the way for the resistance front and nullified the sinister schemes of the United States and the Zionist regime, which were trying to disintegrate regional countries through their mercenaries and also through Daesh terrorists, which they controlled. U.S. President Donald Trump openly admitted that he issued the order for the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, but later evidence also proved Israel's role in this act of terrorism. The Zionist regime's Minister of War, Naftali Bennett, referring to what he called the time of ending of Iran's presence in the region, had offered menacing remarks against Iran. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had a telephone contact with U.S. Secretary of State just 3 days before this act of terrorism. Netanyahu had thanked Mike Pompeo for important measures against Iran. Pompeo acknowledged in a speech that the IRGC has been blacklisted because of its threats against the Israeli regime. The Israeli Daily Jerusalem Post wrote that Mike Pompeo had said this in the session of the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee. It doesn't matter because the United States and Israel are the two sides of the same coin. The act of terrorism against Iran's top general and military commander had been put on American and Israeli agenda at a time that Washington's maximum pressure policy against Iran has been seen to be failing. The United States has been frustrated because its embargo and economic sanctions were not working against Iran. The multi-million strong funeral ceremonies for the heroes of resistance, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were a clear message to the criminal regime in Washington and the regime in Tel Aviv and their accomplices and their allies in Europe. The global arrogance and global Zionism fully realized that hatred against them had spread well beyond Iran and Iraq, into Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, and the wider region, and even parts of Europe. This volcano of disgust against the United States and the Israeli regime cannot be extinguished by tweets and threats. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, referring to the elements of the Iranian nation's power and steadfastness against the enemies, had said, "The enemy has tried its utmost. It has not come short in its wickedness. The aim is to force officials to capitulate and change their calculations and to submit to U.S. demands. It means that they surrender to the United States and people are put against the system. This is the enemy's goal. America's calculations are wrong. They are misguided. They have made such calculations for the past 40 years and have not gained any results. They have lost and they have failed to deliver a blow to the Islamic Republic. It is the same now. This time, too, they will definitely be defeated. There is no doubt about it. Yet, despite the grudge that they have against the Islamic Iran, this has blinded them. I mean, it has destroyed their calculations and they cannot make proper calculations." Dear listeners, Recent developments in the region bode well for the future of this region, and the United States will soon be forced to leave this region. The countdown has already started. The Iraqi Parliament's ratification on 5th of January 2020, demanding that all U.S. military forces should leave Iraqi territory, is in effect the start of the countdown for America's exit from the West Asia region.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Nimitz operated in the Persian Gulf for 2 months until early November. That's the longest time that a U.S. aircraft carrier has spent in this region since 2018. An Israeli submarine headed for the same region, coinciding with a sighting of submarine USS Georgia. On December 9, two American B-52 bombers headed for the Persian Gulf, accompanied by Saudi aircraft. All this ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of Iran's senior commander, Soleimani, in a U.S. drone attack near Baghdad Airport. What's the widespread deployment for? Would this stabilize the Middle East region or stir the situation? Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our correspondent, Colin Campbell. There, Colin, tell us about how the media has been covering this and reactions to this.
Well, to answer your first question, I would say not very much at all, to be honest. We're really focused a lot here on COVID-19 and the rise of the number of Americans who are dying from a pandemic that the government did not responsibly respond to. But as far as other elements of media that are covering this event, there are some that are speculating as to why there is such a buildup of the Navy in the around the Strait of Hormuz. And that could be to send a sign to Iran for some reason or another as we battle also with a transition of power here in the country. We have a president who seems very reluctant to relinquish power to the incoming president-elect Biden. But, of course, the real difference will happen on January 20th. That's really the day that the president-elect will be inaugurated. But along the way, it doesn't seem like the current president wants to give in to that or accept the terms of the election. So, meanwhile, he's building up the Navy in this region, along with his leaders in foreign policy, to show a sign to Iran that we're still very active in that region. And so if there's any type of aggression that is directed towards the U.S., now is not the time to do it. But again, that's mere conjecture. We're not really sure exactly why there is such a buildup there. We do know that it's the first time in decades that so many members of the Navy have gone there, especially when you see these types of posturing with the USS Georgia going through the Strait of Hormuz, accompanied by other submarines, which pack a lot of firepower. And one has to imagine that this is just something as an act of intimidation, perhaps, or an implicit type of threat that is supposed to be taken as an implication of potential provocation if there is a feeling of being threatened by Iran towards the U.S.
I got to apologize for the technical glitch that happened in the live show. It's natural. So I got to thank our correspondent, Colin Campbell, who joined us from Washington, D.C., and told us about the reactions of the media and also relevant to stories. Now, I'll be joined by national security analyst and political commentator Brian Downing out of Florida. Brian, good to have you with us. General Kenneth McKenzie, Jr., who heads the U.S. Central Command, says the deployment is an example of Washington-Tel Aviv's what it calls a strong working relationship and shared commitment to regional security and stability. Is this in good faith?
Well, it could be seen as simply signaling that there's not a war coming, that there is not an attack coming. I've been very skeptical of these war's imminent scenarios for many, many years. It doesn't mean I'll be correct this time. But I don't think there is going to be an attack. I think Trump is really just posturing, signaling, preening, beating his breast. I don't think he's going to do it. I don't think the generals want to do it. The generals and admirals don't want it. They have priorities elsewhere. They have been stuck in wars in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan for up to 20 years now. They see bigger fish in the geopolitical world out there. They would, if they were given an order today or in the next few days to attack Iran, I think they would say, well, we don't have enough assets in the area. They probably do, but they'll still say that. And the United States has had more assets in the Persian Gulf than they have right now. I think they'll say they have to consult our allies. They may even pull the MasterCard and say, we have to consult Congress. That would certainly be a first in American foreign policy in quite a while. No, I just don't think that there is a war coming. Could be wrong this time, but that's my view.
Okay. Now, from San Francisco, we have Richard Becker, who is with the Answer Coalition, also joining us. Good to have you with us, Richard. Some observers argue that the recent military deployments by Israel, the U.S., and Saudi Arabia aim to dissuade Iran from responding to the killing of its nuclear scientists, Fakhrizadeh. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that the situation is a dangerous situation that exists now. And the fact that nuclear weapon-equipped ships are being sent into the region, not that they're not there a lot, but that they're very openly saying, you know, we're coming in. The Navy doesn't usually announce ahead of time, or many times they don't announce at all. Where they have deployed nuclear weapons carrying equipment, ships, but they did this time. And your other guest may be right that this may be a show of force. I certainly hope that it is. The weaponry, though, that's deployed there is enough to not only destroy Iran, pretty much able to destroy the world. And, you know, there has been, over the last 70 years, there have been many, many close calls to the use of nuclear weapons, some of them are completely unintentional, some of them based on misreading the skies. That almost happened. And so, you know, any time that you take this weaponry out and you deploy it, and it's deployed all over the seas, all over the world, particularly in the U.S. Navy with its nuclear weapon ships, it runs a risk. So I don't think that the Iranian government has any interest at all in war, of course, and has to really take into account the fact that they're seeing this deployment. And it's not only the U.S., but Israel, which has, I believe, recently become nuclear weapons equipped with its submarines through the aid of Germany, has also deployed into the region. So it's there's a huge deployment of military force there. It constitutes a danger. And the U.S. acts here and through the corporate media here as if Iran is doing the provocation, when in fact this is clearly a provocation by the United States and Israel.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, since November, Tel Aviv has put its embassies on high alert. And also Richard mentioned, it's also dispatched a submarine to the Persian Gulf. Are these the right moves? What could be behind this?
Well, I think a lot of the embassies are on alert around the Middle East, American, Saudi, just about all of them. I think the weapon to look at would be the massive order, the targets to look at would be the nuclear uranium enrichment plants at Natanz and Bordeaux. They're about, I think, 100 miles south of Tehran. Well, they're very difficult targets. You're not going to damage them with cruise missiles or conventional ordnance. They are most susceptible to something called the massive ordnance penetrator, which is a huge bomb that burrows very deep into the ground. The Natanz facility is under about 300 feet of bedrock, and Bordeaux is burrowed into a mountain. They're very difficult targets. They would be the most highly desired targets from Israel's perspective and the neoconservative perspective. They can fly from the United States. They can go on B-2 Spirit bombers that would fly off from New Mexico and or Missouri. They can be refueled over along the way. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think it's posturing, and I think, as the previous guest said, signaling Iran that it should not retaliate robustly for the assassination of the nuclear scientists. Trump may want to just leave the region in a mess for Biden. I just don't think so. I think we're dealing here with smoke and mirrors, sound and fury. We've seen it before.
Yeah, Brian, Richard mentioned, Brian mentioned something. Many of our other experts I've talked to also mentioned the same thing, that this is the last days of President Trump at the Oval Office, and he's doing certain things, and he may want to, as other guests said, to leave the region in a mess. Something for a president like Joe Biden to go ahead with and try to tackle. What's your opinion?
Well, I think that it's clear that Trump is highly in a highly erratic state. I mean, he usually is more so than usual. I think that it's possible that he could order some kind of action. I think that I don't think that the military commanders are looking for that. And the reason that I think they're not looking for it is not that I wouldn't like to bring down Iran and bring down the government of Iran. Iran's a large country, has a large population, it's quite developed and so forth. But at the same time, the national security strategy of the United States, which was adopted, the most recent one, I believe it was in December 2017, said that the main item on the agenda, theater of conflict would be with really China and Russia. That it talked about major party conflict. You can't take that any other way, and Iran is not a major power in that regard. Iran does not have nuclear weapons. China and Russia do. China is really seen as the number one problem by the U.S. ruling elite. In that they see China as overtaking the U.S. in different ways, economically, and not militarily, certainly, but politically in terms of its influence around the world. So that's really, and you can see both from all of the advisors around Biden, as well as Trump, that they see China as their main enemy in the coming period. But I have to say again that the deployment of so much military force, if you look down through the history, you can see, I was actually just looking at it today, the photos of the collisions that have taken place between warships and the possibility that collisions could cause a nuclear disaster. There's no question that that can happen. And the war sometimes happens without either side intending war to happen. They climb the escalation ladder, as it's called, step by step, but end up somewhere where neither side perhaps wanted to be at the beginning. So this kind of war gaming, if that's what it is really hazardous.
Okay. Brian, let's take a look at another aspect of the story. Iran has offered the Hormuz Peace Initiative to Arab states, the Persian Gulf littoral states, while Tel Aviv has tried to forge relations with them, especially under this U.S. brokered so-called normalization deals, and that's on shared concerns about Iran. So who's assumed a destabilizing role in West Asia?
Well, I would say that the Sunni powers have really begun a lot of this out of dynastic ambitions by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and out of religious hatred. Well, that's their view. I just hate to see the United States dragged into this, into their prejudicial programs. You know, if I were to embark on a policy of making America great again, to coin a phrase, I don't think I'd want to be led around the Middle East by the nose by Saudi Arabia and other powers. You cannot be a great power if you're just so easily manipulated by these people. It's not the way to be a great power.
Mm-hmm. Richard, let's have your comment on the same question.
Well, I don't think that the U.S. is really being led around exactly. I think that, that this is the decisions that are being made in Washington and decisions that include the shipment now of huge amounts of new weaponry to Saudi Arabia to use against the people in Yemen, mm-hmm. where half the population is in danger of starvation. You know, and because this is the relationship with Saudi Arabia, Biden may be a little bit more critical of it, but it's not going to break up the relationship. This is a long-standing relationship. Saudi Arabia really exist as a country because of the U.S. and Britain helped to bring one family to power, and it's been there for a long time, and the vast amounts of oil and the hundreds of billions, really it's trillions and trillions of dollars now in wealth that has originated from Saudi Arabia and ended up in the banks of New York, and in particular New York and London and so forth. So this is, it's a very important relationship, and U.S. policy over the last 75 years, almost 75 years now, has been, once they got out of World War II and set up the CIA and embarked on a whole course of empire on a much wider scale, has been to prevent any independent powers in the Middle East that aren't willing to toe Washington's line. That's the real history. If you really look at it in the overview, so nationalist governments, mass movements, socialist movements, communist movements, progressive movements of all kinds have been seen as the problem from Washington's point of view. And I think that that goes for Yemen today as well. It goes for all the forces in the region which aren't bowing before Washington. And then the aim is to crush them.
Now, Brian, let's take a look at the U.S. military presence and deployment in different parts of the world. Can you cite a spot on planet where U.S. military deployment has restored peace and security as they climate the record in countries in this part of the world, including Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, you know, tells you otherwise?
Quick answer there is no. I would have to go back to World War II when I think American policy stabilized Central Europe and East Asia. But other than that, I think the wars in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, not so much Afghanistan since the troubles sort of predated the American presence there. But I think it's just led to chaos, havens for Al-Qaeda, resentment resentments against the United States in the region, and stress between the United States and longstanding allies in Europe and Asia. You know, to go back to that phrase, making America great again, American greatness was always based on strong alliances, and Donald Trump doesn't know that, and Joe Biden is going to have to repatch things in the next few years, which I think he can do. I think those countries want a strong America on their side. I'm talking about Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and East Asia, not so much the Middle East. But no, Trump has just shown no knowledge of foreign policy, alliances, history. He's an arrogant, erratic person, and happily he'll be gone in a few weeks without doing more damage.
Okay. Richard, what's the right way toward restoration of calm and tranquility to West Asia region? Military deployments or dialogue and diplomacy?
Well, it's clear, I think, and I would agree with the other guests about this, is that it's created the military strategy, the strategy that's been carried out. And I do have to say, though, it's not just Trump, but it's all the recent administrations have thought that they could solve the problems mainly through military deployment. And the reality is that it has just created conditions that are abhorrent to so many people in the region. I mean, Syria is torn apart, Iraq is torn apart, Libya is torn apart, Yemen is torn apart. The result of the U.S. interventions has nothing to do with democracy or wasn't motivated by democracy or human rights. All you have to do is look at Saudi Arabia and look at that relationship and then try to say, oh, the United States government, various administrations have been concerned about human rights in the region. I mean, so that's a terrible joke for the people who live in Saudi Arabia. But the reality is that whatever the tactics have been up until now, they have just created more and more suffering for people in the Middle East. And really, the United States needs to be out of the Middle East.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. From the Answer Coalition, we had Richard Becker out of San Francisco, and national security analyst and political commentator Brian Downing joined us from Florida.
U.S. President Donald Trump's 11th-hour decision to blow up the stimulus negotiations has also jeopardized much-needed financial relief for millions of Americans. Rather than showing a genuine effort to pressure Senate Republicans to agree to legislation House Democrats passed in May, which would have provided $1,200 checks for individuals and up to $6,000 per household, Donald Trump decided to intervene only after Congress finally agreed on individual payments of $600, saying he wanted $2,000 checks instead. President Trump has also used his remaining time in office to dole out presidential pardons that exemplify the absolute worst use of this constitutional power. Rather than employing the pardon as a mechanism to provide mercy and justice, Donald Trump has saved his powers for his cronies. Russiagate alumni Roger Stone, who was convicted of 7 felonies, including obstruction of justice, threatening a witness, and lying under oath. Paul Manafort, who was convicted of 8 counts of financial crimes. Alex van der Zwaan, who pleaded guilty to lying to investigators. George Papadopoulos, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. And Michael Flynn, who twice pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI, were all pardoned by Donald Trump, likely as a reward for their loyalty. We now present you an article written by Julian Zelizer, a political analyst and a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. The piece is titled Trump's Wrecking Ball of a Transition. The article has appeared in CNN.com's website. Please stay with us for more of Julian Zelizer's article. This has been a disastrous lame duck period. Although there are always concerns about what may happen in the months between a U.S. presidential election and inauguration, the last few weeks have lived up to Americans' worst expectations. The transition period used to be even longer. Until the 20th Amendment was ratified in 1933, this gap lasted from early November until 4th of March, when presidents were inaugurated. This four-month gap allowed U.S. Congress to count and report votes and gave the president-elect sufficient time to travel to the Capitol. But the problems that could arise during this time, along with technological advances that cut down on travel time, created pressure to shorten the window, especially after the infamous secession winter of 1860 left President-elect Abraham Lincoln powerless as several southern states left the Union to form the Confederacy. The 20th Amendment moved Inauguration Day to 20th of January, as set the start date for a new Congress on 3rd of January. If the American nation needed one last reminder of why the shift was necessary, they got it after the 1932 election, when President-elect Franklin Delano Roosevelt was unable to launch the New Deal for months amidst the deteriorating economic crisis of the Great Depression. However, it turns out that even 2 months is no guarantee of a smooth interregnum. President Donald Trump has managed to use his remaining time in office to act as a political wrecking ball, whilst the country is still being ravaged by the COVID-19 pandemic. Donald Trump, who had been spouting claims of voter fraud for months, launched several failed lawsuits in an attempt to challenge the election results in key swing states, and also contacted state legislatures to try to persuade them to intervene on his behalf. Even when this strategy proved unfruitful and his attempt to hold on to power looked increasingly desperate, the president continued to maintain that the controversial election had been rigged. While President Donald Trump has been unsuccessful in his efforts to overturn the election, he may have succeeded in sowing distrust among many in the United States, fanning the flames of the toxic political atmosphere and likely making governing that much more difficult for President-elect Joe Biden. Donald Trump has also set a precedent for future presidents to dispute the election results on controversial claims. And to make matters worse, Trump has delayed the transition process and made it more difficult for the Biden administration to hit the ground running on day one. While attacking the election, the president has fumbled the issue of the moment, the country's pandemic policies. As states face a winter surge and intensive care units reach capacity, Donald Trump has turned a blind eye to the millions of American families that are suffering as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Despite 18 million cases, more than 330,000 deaths, and millions facing economic hardship, there has been little direction from Washington about what states need to be doing right now to curb the spread of this horrible virus. Although 1 million Americans have already gotten the COVID-19 vaccine, that falls far short of the administration's goal of inoculating 20 million Americans by the end of December. General Gustav Perna, the chief operating officer of Operation Warp Speed, apologized for miscalculating the number of doses that would be sent out to several states, and there have been staffing and planning problems that have slowed the process. President Trump's 11th-hour decision to blow up the stimulus negotiations has also jeopardized much-needed financial relief for millions of Americans. Rather than showing a genuine effort to pressure Senate Republicans to agree to legislation House Democrats passed back in May, which would have provided $1,200 checks for individuals and up to $6,000 per household, Donald Trump decided to intervene only after Congress finally agreed to individual payments of $600, saying he wanted $2,000 checks instead. President Trump has also used his remaining time in office to dole out presidential pardons that exemplified the absolute worst use of this constitutional power. Rather than employing the pardon As a mechanism to provide mercy and justice, Donald Trump has saved his powers for his cronies. Russiagate alumni Roger Stone, who was convicted of 7 felonies, including obstruction of justice, threatening a witness, and lying under oath. Paul Manafort, who was convicted of 8 counts of financial crimes. Alex van der Zwaan, who pleaded guilty to lying to investigators. George Papadopoulos, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. And Michael Flynn, who twice pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI, were all pardoned by Donald Trump, likely as a reward for their loyalty. Trump also offered presidential relief to corrupt Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter, who pleaded guilty to a charge of conspiracy to misuse campaign funds. Also to Steve Stockman, who was convicted of a number of felonies, including fraud and money laundering. And to Chris Collins, who was serving time on charges of conspiracy to commit securities fraud and making a false statement, along with Charles Kushner, the father of son-in-law Jared Kushner, who was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison for retaliating against a federal witness, evading taxes, and lying to the Federal Election Commission. Four Blackwater security guards were also pardoned by President Donald Trump after a lengthy trial found them guilty of killing 14 innocent Iraqi civilians in 2007. The list goes on, and is sure to grow in the coming weeks. Whilst Donald Trump is certainly not the first to use his presidential powers in terrible ways, the scale and scope of his decisions, many of which are unjustifiable, moves him to the very top of the list. Given all that has happened during this transition, some commentators wonder whether Congress should reduce the time between election and inauguration even more. It's unclear whether doing so is possible or desirable. In an age where the responsibilities of the president have expanded as a result of the growth of government, there is something to be said for allowing enough time for a new president to establish his administration and prepare for the challenges ahead. But we have learned once again just how much leeway there is within the U.S. political system for presidents to misuse their power and to create immense instability. Even if Congress doesn't shorten the transition period, there are safeguards it can put into place. This transition has given Americans more than enough reason to revisit their election laws, provide more clarity about the Electoral College certification process, and rein in the executive.